Mike or Steve, if you could let Crystal know that I think the air conditioning is not on enough. I'm going to be preaching about heaven and hell, and I don't want any opinions swayed by the physical environment. What happens after we die? What do Unitarian Universalists believe? I feel the heavenly breeze. That's what we hope for. But what do Unitarian Universalists believe happens after we die? That depends on whom you ask. We do affirm the importance of how we live in this life. Just as long as we have breath, what matters is the way we treat other people and how we live on this earth. But after the breath stops, what then? We don't have one answer. Some Unitarian Universalists find this to be frustrating about our faith tradition. Others find it liberating. And of course, a few folks from other faiths make fun of us for not having one account of what happens after you die, especially because it's not their account. Yet such impatience with our diversity ignores the historical diversity of thought that has existed within major spiritual traditions on this question. This includes the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They have some things in common. For example, the scriptures of all three share some ideas and images of a day of judgment, a final time when everyone's deeds and everyone's faithfulness to God will be measured. And as a result of that measuring, people will be either punished or given paradise. Tied to this idea are concepts in all three traditions of a bodily resurrection of all people, envisioned also as happening on or after that day of judgment. While all three faith traditions have developed concepts about a resurrection, it is Christianity which has celebrated these concepts and highlighted them the most and centered them around the figure of Jesus Christ. For example, a glossy brochure arrived in my mailbox just a week or two ago from an evangelical Christian organization. The brochure quotes the Gospel of John, saying that Jesus will raise the dead on the last day when he comes again to earth. It quotes the Apostle Paul, saying in one of his letters, "We shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised." In the United States, at least, it seems that we hear about a final judgment and a resurrection mostly from evangelical and some other Christians, more than from other religious traditions. We hear about it in the mailbox, on TV, and the internet, on billboards, and sometimes knocking on the door. Most Muslims, in contrast, promote living by the five pillars of the faith and do not emphasize the afterlife that much. And going even further, modern-day Judaism stresses the importance of this life in this world. The point in Judaism is not a reward in the future. The point is to love mercy, do justice, and walk humbly with God. Looking just a little bit more now at the Christian tradition, I want to point out a complication. From the early years of Christianity, existing somewhat awkwardly alongside concepts of bodily resurrection at the end times, has been the idea of an immortal soul. The soul in each one of us, which lasts beyond this life. This is what folks mean, I think, when they say someone has gone to heaven. Their soul, not their body. Early Christians inherited this idea from Greek philosophy, especially from Plato. The soul distinguishes that which is alive from that which is not alive. It is our vital essence. Though invisible, the soul animates us. It gives us our sense of who we are, our personality, our motivation. We satisfy the soul by doing work that is meaningful, by being creative, by consuming delicious food, or enjoying a symphony or a song or some other work of art. Soul satisfying, we say. It can be hard to imagine that something that motivates us, enlivens us, and connects us to others would merely vanish when our body stops working. Human consciousness is a miracle to me, and human love is a blessing. Both are so powerful that it's hard to imagine they don't continue after the body stops. Hence the appeal to those early Christians of that Greek idea of the immortal soul. Centuries before that, however, Hinduism developed the full-scale philosophy of the transmigration of souls. This means that each of us, indeed each living being, is the home to a soul, and we are the manifestation of that soul's existence while we are alive. But your soul had other manifestations before you, and it will go on to another being after you are gone, and mine will go on after I am gone. And as I understand the doctrine of karma, the choices we make in each lifetime will have an effect on our future incarnation. The lessons we learn will go with our soul to help us out in the next lifetime. This is appealing, taking lessons along to our next incarnation. But what I wonder then is, why can it be so hard to follow the lessons we learn while we are still in this lifetime? Why do we have to wait to take them? Why is it so hard to follow them now? In any case, Hindu ideas of reincarnation were inherited by the younger religion of Buddhism when it emerged in the north of India and in Nepal. The most famous recent example is the Dalai Lama of Tibet. When he was a boy, he was identified by leaders as the reincarnation of the prior Lama, actually of every earlier Dalai Lama. He was the reincarnation. And now an older man, this modern Lama has said, with a subversive twinkle in his eye, that quite possibly the Lama's next reincarnation will be in the person of a little girl. Well, our religious denomination has finally elected a female president, so why not? By now, a curious questioner might insistently ask, so what does Unitarian Universalism say about what happens after death? Where do we end up after this body and brain cease to work? What happens to us? Is it heaven, reincarnation, or topsoil? Which answer you get depends on whom you ask, and we make no apology for that. As I described, historically there has been more diversity in Christian beliefs on such questions than we might be led to think these days. How about this answer? We don't know. We cannot know for sure what happens. I am curious to find out, but not so curious that I can't wait for a few more decades. Maybe I won't find out. Nothing to find out. Or maybe I will have a big, unpleasant surprise. The air conditioning never comes on. But we don't know. I have not taken a survey of Unitarian Universalists and their beliefs on this, but I have a guess. Some of us believe in heaven, some believe in an immortal soul, and some in reincarnation. Probably very few, if any, believe in hell or the resurrection of the body, but that belief is no barrier to being part of this community. I bet that many UUs would choose my third answer, topsoil. Earth to earth, a natural body reclaimed by nature. After we die, we exist only by what we have done, what we have given away, and the lives we have touched. We exist in beloved memory and through our legacy. But I think the majority of UUs might say, we don't know. I do believe that whatever it is that happens after we are dead, this happens to everyone, all people. There is no sorting of the sheep and the goats among us, no granting of immortality only to those lucky enough to believe the best Bible verse or to be in the right religion. Heaven, reincarnation, or topsoil, I don't know, but whatever it is, it's there for you and me and everyone. I feel the need to point out how privileged many of us are to be able to speculate on such a question here in the United States in the early 21st century. Speaking for myself, I have grown up with reliable access to health care, food, and shelter. I have lived longer than many people in earlier generations would have lived. And since I was born, many preventions or treatments have been developed for afflictions from which I might have died if I had been born in an earlier generation or in a poor country or in a zone of conflict. I have not fought in a war. I've not had to put my life on the line like police officers, firefighters, or international peacekeepers and relief workers. I have grown up in a society which grants a greater degree of privilege and safety to me as a male than it does to people of other genders. I have grown up as a white male person in a social system which has granted me privilege and protection, whereas the majority of people in other categories in our system have lived a precarious existence. I have not experienced the fear of parents of boys with black bodies having to tell them to stay away from certain places at certain times of day, lest they be lynched. I have not had to worry that a child of mine wouldn't come home because he hung with a dangerous crowd, or because he became another story about a young man of color being shot in an encounter with the police, in spite of being unarmed or unthreatening. Many people in this country and many people around the world are far more anxious about getting through this life and the next day. And I am privileged to be able to stand here and imagine a long life and wonder with you about eternity. Some people say that death is a gift. Its finality reminds us how important life is and how much we appreciate life. And the arrival of death can seem like a relief at the end of a long life or at the end of a long ordeal of suffering by disease or by the indignities of physical and mental decline. Yet for too many people in the world, in our own country, in our own communities, death is not a gift, but a tragic, unfair, and unjust reality. This is the hell that is real. The violence that we live in, suffer in, and cause to ourselves, and to our fellow human beings, and our planetary home. This is the hell that is real. Personal actions that cause harm and a social system that suppresses human potential and snuffs out lives too early. This is the only kind of hell that our spiritual ancestors believed in, the hell that we inflict on one another or the hell that lives in our suffering bodies and minds. I'm talking about the American Universalists, people of the late 1700s and early 1800s, in New England. They saw suffering around them and they took action to mitigate suffering, to feed people, to free prisoners, to care for the sick, to build schools. The greatest accomplishment of our Universalist forebears was the healing of spiritual suffering. In the late 1700s, the dominant theology of New England was Calvin Puritanism. You heard Jenny talk about that earlier. And Puritanism had an answer as to what happens after we die. Hell happens. For all but a few, all but an elect few, predestination meant that we were all going to end up in hell. And salvation was an elite gift. The doctrine of predestination meant that nothing you could do would save you, no beliefs, no good deeds. The Universalists read the same Bible, and they disagreed. Salvation is universal, they said. If you get somebody really pressing you about what we really believe, you can say, we believe that salvation is universal because love is universal. They said that the Bible showed the character of God and that that character is love. They said it was like the love of a parent for a child. Universalist preachers proclaimed that in the life of the prophet Jesus, you could see that God's nature is love. And in 1803, nearly two decades before the Unitarians had even organized themselves in New England, the Universalists built churches, held tent revivals, and they even adopted a statement of beliefs. They called it the Winchester Profession. In 1803, this is part of what the Winchester Profession said about God and humanity. We believe the one God will finally restore the whole family of humanity to holiness and happiness. This means, I think, that in God's time we will all be reconciled no matter what. This means that everyone goes to heaven, even those who don't deserve it. The Reverend Gordon McKeeman, who died last year, was a Universalist minister in this country, and he was also, for a time, the president of our UU seminary in Berkeley, Star King School for the Ministry. And McKeeman wrote about universalism this way: picturesquely spoken, the image of universalism was that of the last unrepentant sinner being dragged screaming and kicking into heaven, unable to resist the power and love of the Almighty. So even if you don't want to go, even if you don't want to be loved, you're loved. That means for us there is no hell, even if sometimes if somebody cuts you off in traffic or if you lose your cool in a heated argument, you want to shout, go to hell. There's no hell. God is love even for the unlovable among us. I know it sounds unfair when you think about it, but that's our inheritance. Given that there is no hell, the Universalists wanted us to work as much as possible to reflect the image of heaven in our own lives here on earth. They said that God would restore the whole family of humanity to holiness and happiness. And what that means is that by being holy, by being good, by doing good works and pursuing justice, we would achieve happiness in ourselves. That's the reward for doing good, not some promise of heaven, but happiness, joy at experiencing that love that transcends everything. An early Universalist preacher once said, if we're going to spend eternity together, we might as well learn how to get along down here. Of course, this vision of love in heaven and love on earth is an ideal vision, and it appeals to folks in other faith traditions. A writer I like is Kathleen Norris, a Christian writer, and in her book Amazing Grace, she writes this: my favorite definition of heaven comes from a Benedictine sister who told me that as her mother lay dying in a hospital, she had ventured to reassure her mother. And she said, in heaven, everyone we love is there. The older woman replied, no, in heaven, I will love everyone who's there. Sometimes we lose a dear person whose heart and mind and love have made a difference. Their spirit has made an indelible impression on us. And when we lose such a person, I believe we continue to experience that spirit. Their spirit stays with us like a companion through our days. And for the rest of us, that experience might suggest that the ways we live and speak and act will endure beyond our lives, and that our spirits will touch others and our spirits will touch this world and leave an impression. And by the legacy we leave, our spirit will show up for a long time after we are gone. So let us pay attention to the ways we choose to have our spirit show up in this life here and now. So may it be. Blessed be. Amen.